You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Russian Orthodox Nationalist, and of course, the creator of this broadcast, this podcast. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson. And for those who've been listening to me for a while, you realize that one of the things I do, and I really revel in, is destroying the mythic structure that the left, that the regime has painted the world. The overwhelming majority of what the normie believes is a myth. Now, I do that in general, in the U.S. and Western Europe, whatever, but I specifically do it concerning old Russia, that is to say, Russia prior to 1917. And for those of you who remember, I did my revisionist analysis of Bloody Sunday, 1905, of the revolution itself, aspects of the Civil War, aspects of the Soviet Union. Today I'm going to do something in that very same vein. Some of you may have heard of the Lena Goldmine Massacre of 1912. So, in a nutshell, on April 4th, 1912, a small column of soldiers was given the order to shoot a group of violent protesters at the Lena Goldfields in northeast Siberia. Now, of course, the Leninists tried to take advantage of this, claiming that the capitalist monarchy fired into a peaceful crowd, carrying flowers and icons. They said the same thing about the Bloody Sunday. And, as always, the left is far better at propaganda than the right is. And nowhere was this more obvious than in old Russia, this very year, 1912. Because of the lies printed by their newspapers, it led to strikes and uprisings throughout the country and the growth of the revolutionary movement. I mean, it was never very large, but it was significant. But as always, when we're dealing with the left, we're dealing with revolutionaries, the truth is always more complex. The Tsar, of course, had nothing to do with any of this. And the curious thing is that given his labor legislation and that of his father, the cause for striking could only be non-enforcement, which was a legitimate problem. His labor legislation obviated the need for strikes, really. Though, of course, unlike the USSR, organized labor was allowed. So whether it be in liberal or Bolshevik Russia, and the two are allies of one another, as Kerensky was an ally of Lenin, the propaganda motifs center around largely made-up, invented scenarios that have a kernel of truth to them, but the idea is to reach people at their emotions, not at their reason. And the U.S. government tended to buy all of that prior to 1917, calling the Tsar a strangler of freedom, making reference to Bloody Sunday or the Stolypin neckties. These are a normal part of the public consciousness, both in Russia and among academic specialists in America. So in this same row stands what is a malicious myth of the Lena massacre. This massacre, during the Soviet era in particular, but by many today, is constantly touted by zealots of the Bolsheviks as evidence of the criminality of bloody czarism. So, of course, because this is an emotional appeal, the emphasis is placed in the fact that an ordinary person who is not burdened by solid historical knowledge or even knows about method will just take their word for it, because, you know, they're scholarly after all. And they'll never, nor do they know how, to independently delve into the documents of that era. And certainly, even if they could, don't have the wherewithal to calmly and objectively analyze these very same documents. So what it comes down to is that the normie will believe the person from the wealthiest institution or the most prestigious institution. Now, it's true, many people died. We don't know how many. The result of this shooting, and there was a stampede afterwards as well. Scholarly circles in Russia or in the U.S. have not landed on a number, because even the very number of participants in the strike and their procession who were shot at, that differs from writer to writer. Now, for my sources, I'm using the Lena Goldfields, a collection of documents. This is edited by Pavel Pospilov. That was put together in 1937, published by the OGIZ, or the History of Factories, which was a regular periodical. Now, on the article version of this, I have it hot-linked. Of course, in Russian, it's not easy to read. But in addition to that, I use materials from the documents of the two investigations. There were two commissions. One of the Tsarist government under Senator Sergei Manukhin, and the Duma investigation, which was presided over by Kerensky himself. A secondary source from Michael Melankon, who came out in 2006, his book, The Lena Goldfields Massacre and the Crisis of the Late Tsarist State, from Texas A&M University Press. And there's a handful of others. But, you know, I haven't done this in a while. But before I get into the details of this, I need to give you some background. It's hard to judge anything unless you know the context. 1912, contrary to Western and leftist myths, Russia had a booming economy, almost zero unemployment. So because of that, and because of the labor legislation, which was the most advanced in the world at the time, the revolution then needed to be forced. A long time ago, I stumbled across an article in the journal Russian Monarchist, in Russian, which came out in 2017, that actually came up with 60 points as to why Russia was a very just and prosperous place, but I've narrowed it down to a few. And most of these were put forth, and are still put forth, by leftists of various stripes, and certainly it became dogma during the Soviet Union. At the time of the Tsar's murder, so a few years after the massacre, the Tsar was not a wealthy man. The family had a fortune of about 4 million rubles in banks in London, but much of that was gone, since during the war, he spent a fortune on charity work, as did his wife. On the other hand, Trotsky, when he died, he had two accounts, one in New York and one in Switzerland, that amounted to roughly 10 times that. Even the number of prisoners in Russia at the time was low, especially compared with the USSR. In 1908, it was 56 per 100,000 from all causes. But by 1940, it was 1,214, and then just a few years later, 1,537. In the U.S., it's 750 per 100,000. And as a matter of custom, no petitions for clemency that reached the Tsar were ever rejected. The amount of taxes per person in 1913 was two times lower than that of France and Germany, and more than four times lower than England. Wages were higher than those of the European world, and were second only after the USA, although the cost of living in Russia was the lowest amongst the developing states and empires, making Russia the world's most prosperous country, especially for ordinary workers. We'll talk more about that here in a minute. Things like the Peasant Bank, founded by Tsar Alexander III, issued loans to peasants, often canceled. They can, you know, be repaid on zero interest. So by 1914, the peasants own 100% of the land in Asian Russia, Siberia, and 90% in the European part of the country. And the Reds never came close to any of this. In 1903, business owners were ordered to pay benefits and pensions for injured workers. Unions were formed starting in 1906. In June of 1912, mandatory insurance for workers against disease and accident, paid by the factory owner, and the law on social insurance, which was before all European variations. You had the most stable currency in the world based on gold and under the Tsar's direction. Sergeyevich said in this regard, Russia's gold currency is under the control exclusively of the Emperor Nicholas II. So even during the world economic crisis, which, by the way, was going on when this massacre took place from 1911 to 1912, Russia continued to grow. And partially because of the Lena mines, Russia's volume of gold reserves was the largest in the world. And the Russian ruble is what you might call the hardest currency in the world, even to the present day to some extent. Industry, the railways, grew rapidly. Third in the world in 1914, the Russian GDP grew by 400% between 1890 and 1913. In 1901, the U.S. produced 9 million tons of oil, while Russia pumped 12 million. Labor productivity was developing very quickly and outstripped the U.S., Britain, and Germany. I should note about oil that it could not be exported abroad. So that means its sale was a purely state matter and went to supporting domestic industry and infrastructure. Even the number of mentally ill people, which I think is people in institutions, in 1913, in old Russia, was 187 per 100,000. But after 100 years of life without the monarchy, that went up to 5,598 people per 100,000 in 2010. The number of suicides was extremely low. And Russian labor legislation, which is really more to the point here, Russia was a pioneer in this regard. So on June 1st, or 13th, depending on the calendar, 1882, a law was passed limiting working hours and the use of child labor. Now, how could something that's already been enacted be a demand of the Bolsheviks? Alexander III ordered a ban on working when you're under 12 years of age. Children under 15 could not be forced to work more than 8 hours, with a mandatory break after 4. Any kind of, you know, heavy industry was out of the question, strictly prohibited. And with the introduction of compulsory education, if you're going to employ a young person, you also had to have a school there. In 1885, the law on the prohibition of night work for miners and women in factories, plants, and manufacturers was introduced and passed. Really, workers under 17, according to this, could not really be involved in any full-time work. On June 2nd, 1898, Emperor Nicholas issued the decree on the duration and distribution of working hours in factory and plant industry establishments, which is extremely important. So the standardized working hours for men were limited to 11.5 and 10 for women. Sunday was always a day off. And a shortened working day was introduced on Saturday. And even this 11.5, you had 2 hours for lunch. Of course, all of the holy days, there was no work on the circumcision, New Year, the baptism of the Lord, the Annunciation of Mary, Transfiguration, Dormition, the Nativity, Christmas days, December 25th and 26th on the old calendar, Friday and Saturday of Holy Week, Monday and Tuesday of Easter week, Ascension Day, and the second Sunday of Pentecost, Holy Spirit Day. So, according to one calculation, Russian workers had about 110 days of rest. So, in any given year, 250 working days. But in Great Britain, the number of working days was over 310. But child labor under 12 was banned in the rest of Europe only in 1902. That was in Italy. In Germany, the ban on children under 12 working in industrial production was only introduced in 1903. So between 1900 and 1904, the working day was about 10 hours. But in Austria-Hungary, Belgium, and Italy, it was 11 hours, and in Germany, about the same. So this kind of obviates the need for strikes, although there may be specific issues. And there is one in the Lena gold mines. There is no objective reason for Russian labor to hate or distrust the Tsarist government, unless, of course, they're being influenced by the popular press. And by the time the war broke out, the 8-hour day was the norm. And, of course, the war and the revolution interrupted all of this. So this background is essential, because we're talking about specific circumstances at the time this massacre took place. It shows that only a few of the demands made by these so-called striking workers were actually real problems, as labor demands all over the world were already enacted. Again, enforcement could be difficult. This is why the Bolsheviks had to invent tragedies. This is why they had to engage in blatant provocation. Now, the strike, which began officially on February 29th of that year, it was led by urban and Jewish leftists, and they had no relationship whatsoever to the workers. And this took place in Yakutia, Bodaibo in particular, which is a small district. In 1967, the Soviet government put up a monument concerning the Lena gold mine massacre, and it says on it, "Victims of a brutal execution who died in the struggle for the cause of the working class." But of course, a lot of that is completely mythic. Now, the text which is in that collection I mentioned, which in my, I have a link to it, Making to Mind Management, these commissions and stuff all reproduced it. They're all, you know, fair. They all make sense. But again, much of this was already done. Like, for example, the strikers demanded that women be not forced to work, that families should be given separate room to live in. But the employment contract the mine workers signed explicitly forbade bringing wives and children. So how did they end up there? Remember, this is in the absolute middle of nowhere. Yakutia is within the Arctic Circle. It's one of the coldest places on the planet. It's far from anything. So bringing families was out of the question. Now, the administration didn't bring women and children there. It was the workers themselves who violated their initial agreement. And then they were indignant that the conditions didn't suit them. Of course it didn't suit them, because it was agreed in advance that the housing was intended for a large number of only men. And the Reds were talking about an 8-hour working day, reduced working hours on certain days, but that was already done too. So this all is based on public ignorance. Again, the Tsarist government wasn't very good at propaganda, nor were they very good at defending themselves. The chronology of events at the mines shows that the violence occurred precisely when the mine administration reduced working hours, prohibiting people from staying in the mines overtime. The left was talking about the 16-hour workday, which was never the case, although occasionally it was voluntarily the case. We'll get to that here in a minute. It was pretty well regulated there, but 11 hours when working in one shift and 8 hours if there were three. Now, workers were allowed, the mines, to stay overtime and were allowed in their own time to look for gold nuggets and hand them over to the administration, in which they got money. Some of them did extremely well. I mean, it started at 1 ruble, but that was worth something at the time. So you did have 16-hour work days, but that was quite voluntary. The conditions, of course, of the mine in Yakutia of all places were far from ideal. And all mines are that way. The salaries were twice as large as the workers in the capital. And because they had an excess of those willing to work, it was cut slightly, but still some of the highest wages in the entire empire. They had their own local store, company hospital, because there was nothing else out there. But in no way was this in a spontaneous rebellion. It was so demonstrative of the left's mentality. Everything was done according to the classic leftist methods like we saw on Bloody Sunday. There was a rumor that poor quality meat had something to do with it. And the people who testified at the commissions, including those who were wounded, say all kinds of things. Kind of like the 1905 Potemkin, battleship Potemkin mutiny, whose crew was manipulated by false news about the Russo-Japanese War. And some of them claimed bad food. But the official propaganda coming out of the Bolshevik camp was identical to that of Bloody Sunday. The same rhetoric to appeal to the emotions. And they were fully aware that they were going to do a lot worse than that. They stressed the peaceful nature of the demonstration. That's classic left. The crowd of workers intended to recapture the leaders, we'll get to this more in a minute, who had been arrested. And the crowd up there, this company had tens of thousands of workers. The soldiers were outnumbered by sixfold at least. But the very fact that it had leaders means it was not spontaneous. There was a blacksmith there named Shishkin, who in his testimony said that the uprising was prepared in advance and on a huge scale. The Jewish Bolsheviks were heavily involved, and the owners of the mine were also Jews. And the Jews on both sides were working together. The funny thing is, these fake photos from the protest site as this was going on, I mean, how many pictures do you think were available of mining enterprises in the middle of nowhere? What luck that a man with a camera happened to be there to record the crimes of the Tsarist regime on the spot. You know how difficult it was to take a picture back then. The Soviet textbook about these events has one of these fake pictures, and the caption reads, "An hour before the execution." Now, maybe people in the crowd it was spontaneous for. But the Reds provoked this for their own purposes. Now, let's talk about the ownership of the mine. The Lena Gold Fields belong to the Lena Gold Mining Partnership. The Russian nickname is Lenzoto. It was headed by Alfred Ginsberg. It was a joint stock company. The majority of the shares belonged to the Lena Goldfields Company. It was registered in London with participation of some British capital. And it shouldn't surprise anyone that Ginsberg himself prospered under Leninism, under Bolshevism. But there was a conflict between the management of that company and the Lena Goldfields. The largest shareholder wanted to directly control the administration of the mines, and Lenzoto naturally resisted this. So the dispute between these economic entities resulted in speculation and stock market manipulation. Any strike and a decrease in the profitability of at least one of the mines contributed to the fall in the stock price. This is one of the reasons I think that Ginsberg was behind this entire thing. But also keep something else in mind. In the Bodyabo region, we're talking about northern Siberia. People working there were a little bit different from your typical industrial factory worker. Some of the more radical people from the peasant environment lived up there. They were attracted by the high pay. Exiled settlers took part in gold mining, among whom the revolutionaries were, and criminals were a dominant element. Things like prostitution, the semi-criminal life, grew up around mines all over the world. But if the men were receiving a minimum salary of 35 rubles for work in the mine, and a specialist would get between 80 and 85 rubles, and women, to the extent that they were there at all, was much lower. Although the company did not want women there. Now, the owners did a lot to modernize the mines. New technologies. They built the first power station, a telephone hookup. But as in all mines, working conditions were difficult. Now, initially, workers were recruited with a contract of 55 rubles a month. Again, twice as much as the average salary in Moscow or St. Petersburg. But once too many people responded, the screws were tightened. Workers had to shop at company stores, Some of their wages were paid in food stamps, which you could use there. But the selling prices for food products are well known in the literature, at least. 60 kopecks, which is essentially a penny, 100 kopecks to a ruble. A pood of meat, which is an older unit of measurement, about 20 pounds. So it was 60 cents. Same thing for a pood of rye bread, 2 rubles and 20 kopecks. This wasn't much. I'm sorry, I should say for meat it was 6 rubles and 60 kopecks. And it went down from there. But if you were a worker with a salary of, say, 35 and 85 rubles a month, the price fell to 41 kopecks for meat, 14 kopecks, and cereals, 24 kopecks. So food was very inexpensive as time went on. So talk about the bad nutrition of gold miners is slightly exaggerated. Again, what is overtime there? Finding these nuggets. It was 1 ruble, 13 kopecks per gram. And it shouldn't surprise you either that during the investigation of the massacre, some of the deceased workers were found to have accumulated between 100, even 500 rubles in their savings. These were not oppressed workers, which is part of the reason why the Leninists had to invent it, had to create agitation, and they relied on public ignorance. Now, the barracks there were meant for men, built very quickly. The heating was poor in the single coldest part of the world, and there wasn't a lot of quality in the rations that you could find in the stores. As I said, some of the salary came in coupons or food stamps that you can redeem in the stores. But again, none of that is, this is a worldwide phenomenon. But the mine was very important to the state, even though it was privately owned. This conflict between the broader company and the Lena mines, they fought with one another, and they used workers as cannon fodder, as did, so here you have Ginsberg and Lenin working together. Although it is true, Linzotto did commit deception when attracting labor. Initially, they were hired at 55 rubles, and then when there were too many workers, it went down to 35. The working contingent there, these were hardly calm or tolerant people. And the socialists were always there, conducting all kinds of political agitation. And it was never stopped. The company eventually banned the independent search for nuggets. The beginning of 1912 was a provocation. It was meant to fuel the strike movement and gave the left kind of a crack to exploit. The strike itself, as I mentioned, February 29th, started at the Andriyevsky mine. It was going to be closed. It was unprofitable. The workers were given suitable conditions for breaking their contracts, and that was done at the initiative of labor. Now, there's a lot of versions as to what caused this. Someone said a worker was sold rotten horse meat, although I don't know how anything could be rotten in that part of the world, especially in February. A woman bought a piece of meat in a shop that was mistaken for a horse penis. Workers found a horse's leg in the common dinner pot and a few others. It's really impossible to say, but rumors were everywhere. I want to note, too, that the salary by itself was greater than anywhere else in Russia, but they didn't have any expenses. Everything was largely provided for them except certain types of food. They did have a common pot, as I mentioned. So technically, you know, I mean, it's kind of like prison. You could live just on the 3 meals a day, or you can buy commissary. So that means these guys could put away a lot of money over a few years and then go home. Anyway, the strike committee was formed, and despite the fact that the Bolsheviks were a minority, they were by far the most active group, and obviously they knew nothing about mining. These were the people who wrote the demands, and some of them the company accepted, including the issue of workers' control over the distribution of the product. Now, the claim is that the administration rejected the 8-hour workday, but to a great extent, that was already in force. And it has more to do with they would have to introduce a third shift if that were the case. And you can't have a long period of time where these men were idle. And the first chairman of the strike committee was a Bolshevik. His name was Pavel Bataryshev. And he was an agitator, a professional agitator. So this had been planned for some time. There was a people's house that the Bolsheviks erected near the camp. That was erected freely at the mines themselves. And in other mines, like the Tikhon-Zidonsky mine in 1911, the administration agreed to make concessions. And these were generally good times in Russia, as I've already mentioned. Now, why is this gold mining firm so important to the state? Mostly because the Lena Gold Mining Partnership produced over a third of all gold in the Russian Empire. Its gold reserves were accumulated there. The state had its reserves there. And under the Tsar, they were the world's largest. And then they introduced the gold standard, and the Tsarist coins were minted from that Siberian metal. And the Treasury had already given Ginsburg large loans. Ginsburg, of course, was a powerful banking family, founded by Edsel Ginsburg, who held a lot of wine farms. And it was Horace Ginsburg, his son, that took over after his death. He was the one who founded Lenzotto in 1896. And then he created, with the English, the financial society called Lena Goldfields. Now, the board of directors, which was elected in June 1909, including his son Alfred Ginsburg, who was a managing director, the directors of the board, M.E. Meyer, G.S. Shemnier, members of the audit commission, V.V. Veck, I don't know if that's Jewish or not, George Schlossberg, Grauman, Vladimir Frilansky, and R.I. Ibnow. You had others, Vladimir Lippin, B.F. Juncker, and A.V. Guvelyakin. But the head of the firm was Horace Ginsburg. The mine was, none of these are Russian names, I don't know if you noticed. The mine was dominated by the Jews. But about 66% of the shares in the partnership belonged to the company Lena Goldfields, which was registered in London. And I mentioned there was a conflict by 1912. And really it was the difference between the Russian and British businesses. It seems, though, that the mine administration, these Jews, deliberately aggravated relations. And people were coming from all over the country. For some reason, in 1912, measures were taken to forcibly evict workers from their homes. Female labor, which is very poorly paid, was used to the fullest extent, despite the fact that in Russian factory legislation, it was prohibited. A lot of political exiles, so this is what Siberia was known for, and some of them worked at Lena Goldfields. And these were some of the people that persuaded the actual workers to make wild economic and political demands. But as far as the strike committee in 1912 was concerned concerning the gold mine, you had Leninists, but you also had Mensheviks, socialist revolutionaries, and anarchists. I mentioned Pavel Bateshev, who, by the way, was a member of the State Duma of the second convocation. Being a Bolshevik, he already served hard labor. Oleg Platonov said, all these fiery revolutionaries wanted to use the workers' discontent for their own political purposes. So in early March, the strike committee raised 6,000 workers, which was not all of them, but anarchy reigned in the Lena Goldfields for that year. Actually, the book Platonov, which I also use, is his book is called The Attempt on the Russian Tsardom. They removed vodka from the government stores for the sake of demanding order. The local police department was minuscule. You had warehouses with dynamite, which was widely used for mining. And there's a man, Nikolai Trechenkov, who was blamed for a lot of this, was killed in 1915. Nikolai Trechenkov was the man who gave the order to shoot. He was the commanding officer of the 300 men that was sent to restore order. And he is unjustly blamed for what happened. He was the head of the Lower Novgorod Security Department, and he was well known as an anti-Bolshevik fighter. He distinguished himself in the liquidation of their movement in Sormova and Konovina. So that aroused the hatred of the left. He was the head of the Irkutsk State Housing Office, But after the Lena events, he was removed from service and transferred to St. Petersburg. But he volunteered for service at the front in 1915. Actually, by 1914, he was a captain in the army. And he died heroically in battle with the Austrians, leading his battalion into an attack. April 4th, this is the day the massacre took place. The communists and anarchists, again, were not workers, were not miners. They were involved in massive, this frantic agitation. About 2,000 workers, protesters moved to the Fedosievsky mine, the administration of the People's House, which was a Soviet institution. And some of the strike committee had already been arrested and was housed there. So this excited procession was blocked by the men under the command of Captain Treshenko, 300 men. And what happened after that, there is no clarity on. You have a crowd of many thousands moving forward, threatening to sweep away the small line of soldiers. Now, later on that month, the left, who had very powerful influence over the media, claimed that the shooting was totally unprovoked, that Tsarism, for some reason, killed its own peaceful workers, no different than Bloody Sunday. But the reports of others, police, many others, say otherwise. The crowd was an extremely violent one, although not inherently so. Many were armed. The interior minister, who was sacked because of this, Alexander Makedov, said that the goal of the crowd on April 4th was to seize weapons, crush the troops, and destroy the mines. And he was right about that. Seizing weapons, meaning weapons belonging to the infantry. He said the same thing in 1917 to Kerensky's Extraordinary Investigative Commission. He says, and I quote, "If a huge crowd of several thousand people attacks a small military unit tasked with maintaining order, then it is in such a position that it can be crushed by this crowd, and therefore it has to shoot." There was no such thing as riot control at the time. He made the decision based on logic and circumstances, and he did act in accordance with police and militia regulations. Now, the number of victims. The variation is so wide that it almost borders on the absurd. Now, the Soviet number was 270 killed and 250 wounded. Another leftist version, over 500 people were wounded. Now, where did this come from? It came from the Bolshevik Patashev, who, by the way, wasn't there. Different sources give different numbers. The Council of Ministers, the Russian Empire, said 372 total, of whom 170 were killed. The commission, the government commission, which interviewed 202 of those wounded, could not come up with a number. Now, there was a Soviet text on this called the Lena Goldfields. That contains the 500 victims, 270 killed and 250 wounded. Leftist newspapers at the time, the Cadet Rec, the liberal Raskoye Slovo, not to mention the Bolshevik Zvezda, they just competed with each other in whipping up hysteria. The pictures that were painted, both with words and literally painted, were massive bloodshed. The Tsar was blamed for everything. I think the Tsar was more confused than anything else. A number of publications at the time, privately owned media sources, simply disseminated data from Patashev. And he had taken it from his absent superiors, which strongly suggests the Bolsheviks were behind this from the beginning. Now, the reports of Treshenkov himself say 107 killed and 83 wounded. Another report from Senator Sergei Manukhin, who visited the region in May 1912 for an investigation on behalf of the emperor, stated only 202 were wounded, with much less killed. Initially, the Bolsheviks said 170 were killed, and only later upped it to 270. The book, The History of Factories and Plants, under which was published by the Soviets, they reported 150 killed and 100 wounded. And that's actually closer to the officer's report. Now, the first to describe the events was Brezhnev Vedomosti, that was owned by Solomon Proper. I can only assume he's a Jew. But the Novaya Vremya, they didn't want to follow the lead of the leftists. They wanted to describe this, not in the leftist way, but without hysteria, emphasizing the essence of what happened. So the correspondent of that newspaper, Novaya Vremya, said, "The crowd, armed with stakes, bricks, and stones, began to menacingly advance on the military unit, which was forced to fire several volleys." So that was a publication that tried to get to the bottom of the conflict. The article was called "In the Kingdom of the Ginsburgs." But the answer as to who was to blame, it ran counter to the left. And here's what they said in that very article. "Bloody excesses occur only when dark forces interfere, allowing themselves to speculate on human blood in the interest of unbridled economic predation or in the interest of political agitation." Now, that very same author in that newspaper wrote that the workers' demands initially were moderate, didn't go beyond anything that was already, in force. But the management of the mines behaved like a state within a state. They were the ones that demanded the strike be suppressed by force, which at the moment it didn't have to do. You have all kinds of false internet sites, the Lena Tragedy, the New Encyclopedic Dictionary, which came out in 2005, repeats word for word that cliche, and it says, "The Lena shooting, reprisal against participants in a peaceful march of strikers." Monstrously oversimplified. This was typical for Soviet agitprop, but the New Encyclopedic Dictionary? So in Soviet propaganda, the Lena Tragedy of 1912 was at the top of their list of so-called Tsarist horrors. Now, I mentioned that Ginsburg was fully accepted by Lenin. That shouldn't surprise you. The Lena Goldfields Company leased the gold deposits of Eastern Siberia in 1925, following Lenin's testament on concessions, since the USSR needed Western investment to industrialize. Now, I also want you to note, those of you who remember my bit of biz done lecture and paper, which was the Jewish conclave in Siberia on the border with China. The reason it was where it was because they had predicted a gold rush there. The fact that it was the Jewish area meant that this new gold stream would be under their control, just like it was in Siberia under Ginsburg, northern Siberia. It says a lot that Ginsburg was accepted by Lenin. Now, the Soviet government owned only 7%, but there's something else. There was a second Lena massacre under the communists. That was in 1938, and that was repressed for a long time. Westerners never heard of it. Now, the NKVD emissary, his name was Basil Kulvets. He was tasked with rooting out dissenters from the Lena Goldfield. He said that there was a large contingent of enemies in Bodaiba, and they need to feel the strength of Soviet power. Thousands of workers were arrested, and these overcrowded prisons up there, there was no prison system in Tsarist Russia, that was worse than torture. This same company, Ginsburg's company, received the concession for almost all of the eastern Siberian gold fields, again, including Lena. The 3 or 4 concession years, he made a huge profit. In fact, Ginsburg even sued the USSR for $65 million, which wasn't settled until 1968 with an agreement. So Ginsburg was more powerful than any of us even realized. So this Kulvets, who was actually the assistant to the head of the Third Department of the NKVD, that concerns counterintelligence, again, he was there to identify enemies of the people. As a result of him, 948 mine workers were shot, and 2,000 were detained. So as they crow about the Tsarist killings, they knew they were going to do this. They knew that it was going to take a lot of violence to impose themselves, but did it in the same place with far more bodies. Kulvets was arrested as a Japanese spy in 1940. He was sentenced to death in 1941, but he got 10 years in the gulag instead. In 1944, there was an amnesty, and he was released. Stalin said, "The brave struggle of the comrades who fell on the distant taiga from the Tsar's bullets has not been forgotten by the victorious proletariat." Now, he said that about the events of 1912, but didn't have anything to say about the 1938 massacre, even though it had been studied, at least privately, at that point. So in 1938, 948 people at least were shot. And that's more than four times. Even the Bolshevik description of the 1912 tragedy. The first Lena massacre, wrote in a newspaper called the East Siberian Pravda, launched the mechanisms of the then imperfect, saddled with the dark forces of civil society, the Duma and the press. And the second was carried out secretly, unbridled terror against its own people based on communist dogma, or leftist dogma in general. To the Communist Party, exaggerating the Lena tragedy and demonizing the Tsarist government and everybody else normally resorted to mass executions of the population. That was how they dealt with dissidents, especially early on. Sorry about that, people. They're shooting off fireworks downtown here. I don't know who wants to watch this in 20-degree weather, but I'm almost positive it's over. Anyway, this was normal. It happened again in 1962 in Novocherkassk over price increases. Anyway, going back to 1912, this could have been handled had the left not, and the Ginsburgs, not been involved. They could have reached an agreement. The workers were not miserable workers. The strike committee, which was not made up of workers, didn't want to reach an agreement. And it was Ginsburg who called in the military. So the situation was automatically heated up. Again, the number of strikers totaled about 6,000, but that's disputed. The local police force was tiny, and the management withdrew itself entirely. Now, more than half the workers didn't want to strike. They were supported and allowed to collect these nuggets. And in fact, the revolutionaries later stated that they voluntarily handed over their nuggets to the Central Strike Committee, and the strike fund was formed from them. Now, of course, that's pure fiction, but to the extent that they were captured by the strike committee, they had to give their nuggets over. A guy by the name of Konstantin Tulchinsky, who was the engineer of the Lensky mining district, he was respected by the workers. But even at this point, Lenzotto still wanted to settle. The majority of the central committee members, though, vowed to end the strike and return to work after Easter. But all agreements were thwarted by the Bolsheviks. They needed an outcome. They needed a more violent outcome. So the violence started when Tretchenkov decided to arrest the strike committee and putting them in the people's house, as I mentioned before. On the eve of the arrest of Bataschev, he left. He never returned to the mines, and he's the one, so he didn't witness anything. He's the one who wrote the initial report. Part of the strike committee was arrested the day before the massacre. So that's when the strike committee demanded the release of those who were detained. So the crowd, about 3,000 people who were willing to go up against the military, they went up to the people's house where there were some members of the strike committee were sitting. Of course, they were blocked. We know that the workers were warned about the military detachment coming, but they didn't take it into account. The Reds said that the soldiers are on our side anyway. So a group of soldiers under Tretchenkov blocked their path. Tulchinsky, the engineer, came out to the workers. He was accompanied by a guard, and tried to persuade them to stop. The front rows did say they were going to stop. These were not people who were absolutely miserable. It was cold. But even if the first few columns stopped, the rest did not, pushing them from behind. The demonstrators were warned about the use of firearms. And the workers who were interviewed by the government committee didn't hide that. They were well aware of it. Troshenkov was given the order to arrest the Central Strike Committee, but there was no instruction to shoot anyone. This was not a peaceful march. No one shoots on a peaceful crowd. They were headed towards a military unit and were going to seize their weapons had the Bolsheviks been allowed to do this. Now, there were no real gun laws in old Russia. It was unenforceable anyway. So some of them had their own weapons, just like in Petrograd in 1905. But his career was ruined. Troshenkov was subjected to endless persecution in the press. But Patashev gets ignored. And there is every reason to believe that this revolutionary collaborated with the Lena Goldfields and the Ginsburg family. Basically, the Bolsheviks said that this crowd, however large it was, peacefully moving with flowers and songs to the prosecutor locally with a complaint about the oppression of the authorities. Of course, that's just not true. At least a core of the workers were armed, and the main goal was to free those at the People's House by force. Then they were going to seize the mine cash desk and the gold that had already been mined at the Enterprise, which was hardly the initial striker demands. The Bolsheviks did everything they could to stir it up. Again, another estimate says 2,000 workers were the ones who were willing to move towards the Fedosievsky mine. Only 300 men. It reminds me of the Kent State fraud, 1970 or 71. The National Guard was attacked by the so-called peaceful hippies, and while they didn't want to shoot, they did. They would have been killed otherwise. They had their back up against a wrought iron fence. And here it was very similar. There was nowhere to run in Yakutia. Here's what Stalin said, this ridiculous hypocrite who said, "Everything has an end, and the end has come for this country's patience. The Lena shots broke the ice of silence, and the river of popular movement began to move. Everything that was evil and pernicious in the current regime, everything that long-suffering Russia was ill with, all this was gathered into one fact, the events on the River Lena." And as I've already mentioned, that caused about another 300,000 around the country to take part in these strikes. You know, the left was brilliant at political deception, propaganda. The truth was buried by it. I mentioned Troshenko was killed in 1915 by a sniper. So this whole thing, if this were a normal strike, it wouldn't have been much of a strike. Only because those in the strike committee had no connection to the mine. They were Jewish, they were political agitators, but as was the owner of the mine, and they worked together. There was a basic demand for living condition improvement, which was legitimate. The company had created a schedule of fines. But at the time, 1912, there was anarchy at the mines only because it was artificially, the flame was artificially stoked. So once the soldiers arrived, though, that's when the agitators went crazy. There were explosives nearby, remember, because they used dynamite in the mines. So the revolutionaries would seize those explosives and weapons. That's why it was blocked. The infantrymen, a handful of them, wouldn't have had any chance whatsoever. And that's when he gave the order to shoot. But the strikers' demands changed regularly. They got more radical as time goes on. The exact same thing happened in Bloody Sunday. That was a complete make-believe fraud. And the same thing for Lena. They were organized and described using the exact same emotional rhetoric. But the Lena mines had to be satisfied. And for reasons of national importance. But they took this somehow as archetypal of the Tsarist government, the inhuman cruelty of that state. It's very difficult to get to this part of the world. When Kerensky visited the area, it took, you know, he had to take boats, he had to take a coach. You know, the river, you know, started off in Irkutsk, in Siberia, all the way up to the far northeast on the Lena River. They had those shitniki, the boats that were pulled upstream by horses. It was raining, it was frozen. Had to go on a steamship. And the kidney disease, you know, I think Kerensky got pneumonia, and it affected his kidneys. And this is what killed Kerensky later on. But the fact that the mine continued to work under the Ginsbergs for God knows how long after the Leninists took over, that should tell you everything you really need to know. The book that Kerensky put together was called The Truth About the Lena Events. It was not, you know, compulsory, but it does reflect, just like the full investigation of the Tsarist era, Kerensky clearly sees both sides. The key factor, though, and Kerensky was aware of this, was that the press was controlled, and the monarchy had nothing to do with it. The left sent press releases, correspondents, agitators, and they told the media what was done, except for that one paper, as I mentioned already. And that paper, and that article, which was really about the Ginsbergs, shows what a scam this whole thing was. There are some people who believe that Kravchenko, because of how he was treated afterwards, that he was looking for death, which is why he attacked the Austrian position and volunteered to go to war in the first place. He was posthumously awarded the St. George Medal. But I've given you really the most basic, stripped-down description of what's going on here. Kravchenko did absolutely nothing wrong. Remember, how old were these kids? Were they the National Guard at Kent State or these guys? They were boys. They knew it was going to be over for them if they were overcome. They absolutely had no choice but to shoot. But in every American textbook, the American government at the time, they accepted whatever the Bolsheviks said without comment, without criticism, and without question. They had dynamite. The Bolsheviks wanted the gold. Remember, the gold reserves were there. That's why the Bolsheviks traveled that far, the Yakutia, to promote this strike, which probably would never have happened anyway. Yeah, there were problems with it, but that's very typical, unfortunately, in the mining world. No one, especially at least in English, no one talks about the second massacre or the third. As I mentioned already, the third was in 1962. The other one was in 1937. No one even mentions this. Because when the Tsar did it, it was to protect capitalism. When they did it, it was to root out enemies of the people. People like, Bolshevik Pavel Batashev, who was not there, but he was the go-between between the party in Petersburg and Moscow and the goldfields. They had the description written out in advance before anything happened, and they were instructed that you have to get them to shoot no matter what. And then, for the sake of sensationalism and to gain readers, the initial Bolshevik explanation, which continued to get more and more killed as time goes on, became exaggerated. And that was exaggerated, and that was exaggerated. So the whole thing was a lie. No one was well aware. They didn't say anything that I said. And this poor Kravchenko was tormented after the fall of the monarchy. But even before then, the left tried to kill him numerous times. And because he was a fighter against Bolshevism, they really wanted it to be him. So if that really was their intention, then they did very well. But the crowd was going to seize weapons. They were going to take the explosives. They were going to kill the troops. They were going to destroy the mines. They were going to take every bit of gold there, and it would have went straight to the Bolshevik party and other leftist parties in general. And the cash that was there. Not that the workers wanted to do that, but their social betters, these Jewish Bolsheviks, they wanted that. And they took down a guy like Treschenko, who volunteered for duty just to get away from this all. And it's because he liquidated the Bolsheviks in Tormova and Konovina. And he earned the fierce hatred of the left. And you know, nothing has changed today. The left talks about Kent State in the same way that the Bolsheviks talked about Lena or Bloody Sunday. It was nonsense from beginning to end. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.